This is January 3rd, the first Sunday of 2010, and it's time, I think many of us would agree, it's time to leave behind the rich food and the desserts and the sleeping in late and get down back to life of self-discipline and back to work and what we know we need to do. And so this Taisho will be about different aspects of how we might best manage to do that, which is difficult for most of us, as far as especially with regard to exercise and perhaps losing weight and just getting to sit every day. And I have four articles from the New York Times that I've been saving for this beginning of a new year that I'll read parts of and comment on. The first one is called Tighten Your Belt, Strengthen Your Mind. And it's by Sandra Amott and Sam Wang, who are, she's the editor-in-chief of Nature Neuroscience, and he is an associate professor of molecular biology and neuroscience at Princeton. And they're the authors of Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive, and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life. In all of these articles, I'll be skipping around a bit because we don't have time to read all of them in their entirety. He's talking about how we've had to come to terms with restraining our shopping, our consumer spending, save some money. And he says, they say, interestingly, restraining our consumer spending in the short term may cause us to actually loosen the belts around our waists. What's the connection? The brain has a limited capacity for self-regulation. So exerting willpower in one area often leads to backsliding in others. This is quite eye-opening and a little sobering. Exerting willpower in one area often leads to backsliding in others. The good news, however, is that practice increases willpower capacity, so that in the long run, buying less now may improve our ability to achieve future goals, like losing those 10 pounds we gained when we weren't out shopping. The brain's store of willpower is depleted when people control their thoughts, feelings, or impulses, or when they modify their behavior in pursuit of goals. Psychologist Roy Baumeister and others have found that people who successfully accomplish one task requiring self-control are less persistent on a second, seemingly unrelated task. So now this first part of the article is about the battles we may lose in our ongoing efforts to exert willpower, self-discipline, and then later it gets into how if we persist at these, even when we alternately win and lose battles, that we're going to win the war. So first, the kind of bad news. In one pioneering study, some people were asked to eat radishes while others received freshly baked chocolate chip cookies before trying to solve an impossible puzzle. The radish eaters abandoned the puzzle in 8 minutes on average, working less than half as long as people who got cookies or those who were excused from eating radishes. And then in another part of this of the experiment, people who were asked to circle every E on a page of text then showed less persistence in watching a video of an unchanging table and wall. no comment needed there. And then they say that other activities that deplete our little tank of willpower are resisting food or drink, suppressing emotional responses, for example, anger, holding, restraining yourself, exercising forbearance, and when you're feeling angry, restraining aggressive or sexual impulses, taking exams, and trying to impress someone, as also all these deplete our tank of willpower. And of course, task persistence is also reduced when people are stressed or tired from exertion or lack of sleep. What limits willpower? And then they don't know for sure, but some have suggested that it's blood sugar. Most cognitive functions are unaffected by minor blood sugar fluctuations over the course of a day, but self-control is sensitive to such small changes. Exerting self-control lowers blood sugar, which reduces the capacity for further self-control. And then here's another detail about their research. People who drink a glass of lemonade between completing one task requiring self-control and beginning a second one perform equally well on both tasks, while people who drink sugarless diet lemonade make more errors on the second task than on the first. Foods that persistently elevate blood sugar, like those containing protein or complex carbohydrates, might enhance willpower for longer periods. That's an important distinction in case anyone missed that. That, of course, eating sweets will elevate blood sugar, but then it's short term. Whereas they found that eating protein or whole grain foods, for example, sustain the elevated blood sugar longer, and then thereby possibly enhancing willpower for longer periods. In the short term, you should spend your limited willpower budget wisely. For example, if you do not want to drink too much at a party, then on the way there, you should not deplete your willpower by window shopping for items you cannot afford. Taking an alternative route to avoid passing the store would be a better strategy. On the other hand, if you need to study for a big exam, it might be smart to let the house cleaning slide to conserve your willpower for the more important job. So, pick your battles, basically. Similarly, it can be counterproductive to work toward multiple goals at the same time if your willpower cannot cover all the efforts that are required. Concentrating your effort on one or at most a few goals at a time increases the odds of success. Now here, this would be something for people who are going to participate in this winter's term intensive, or other future term intensives might file away. Concentrating your effort on one or at most a few goals increases the odds of success. And I would urge, if it's one goal, that it certainly be in increasing the sitting you do every day. Now the good news: we have a limited tank for willpower in the short run, but in the long run, we can enlarge it over on and on. And that's what they focus on now. Focusing on success is important because willpower can grow in the long term, like a muscle. Willpower seems to become stronger with use. The idea of exercising willpower is seen in military boot camp, where recruits are trained to overcome one challenge after another. This is also true in certainly in a session or extended periods of sitting, during which we are called upon to pass through one obstacle after another. This is how we develop this willpower, like a muscle. In psychological studies, even something as simple as using your non-dominant hand to brush your teeth for 2 weeks can increase willpower capacity. People who stick to an exercise program for 2 months report reducing their impulsive spending, junk food intake, alcohol use, and smoking. They also study more, watch less television, and do more housework. So this is great stuff in terms of finding a way to do what I know so many people here want to do. I hear these kind of questions: how do I get myself to sit? How do I get myself to exercise and you know, stop smoking or drink less? I hear this so often, and this is very good practical advice based on research. Pick our battles, but keep at it, even when we lose some of those battles, and then over time, we'll develop this ability to say no to things we know are not helping us at all. And then it just ends by saying, no one knows why willpower can grow with practice, but it must reflect some biological change in the brain. And then he just speculates about the different parts of the brain that I won't go into. I think here too of the kind of backlash that can sometimes happen. Say after a session, many people have reported come out of a session and they just sort of lose all sense of restraint for a short period of time, eating too much, talking too much. Okay, then let's understand that we're more vulnerable after a week of sustained exertion and self-discipline, but not to despair because of that what happens. Maybe it would also cause us to be more vulnerable at the brunch following Taisho, when we've made the effort to get here, especially on a day like this. Congratulations, by the way, to everyone who made it here through this bitter Arctic weather. But watch out at the brunch. And then I'm going to go from here to exercise, because this is no one who does any reading at all can deny that exercise is extremely important for our body-mind health. And it's the trouble, of course, for almost all of us, is getting ourselves to do it. Big excuse that's commonly used is not having enough time. I just can't find the time. I'm so busy. But it should be non-negotiable. I know for myself, I go through periods where I just cannot find the time to get to my fitness club as often as I would want to, but I never let myself off the hook. I mean, there's nothing more important. In fact, when you're most busy and stressed is when you need the exercise the most. But how to get to do it? And what kind of exercise? That's the topic of this next article. It's called More Than an Exercise in Vanity, and it's by Gina Colata. We're not told who she is. But it focuses on healthy muscles. Researchers say it is important because muscle health is emerging as an important part of overall health. And they say when it comes to muscles, bulk does not matter. How big they can become depends on your sex as well as genetics. What matters for health is whether you use them. Healthy muscles, researchers say, are those that have been worked, stressed, and pushed to their limit so that they have enough power and strength to get you through life, especially as you grow older. And keeping muscles fit takes effort, which means regular training with weightlifting and cardiovascular exercise, even if the results are not a sculptured look. If you don't work your muscles, they will atrophy, especially as you grow older. Let's just repeat that. If you don't work your muscles, they will atrophy, especially as you grow older. Older people often fall because they are too weak to brace themselves, and they have trouble with steps and opening jars because their muscles have lost so much strength. Much of that loss can be avoided, muscle researchers say. Even elderly people can gain muscle strength if they work at it. There are two aspects to healthy muscles, endurance and strength. To maintain endurance, you should engage in activities that pump blood to the muscles, like walking, or of course, running and so forth. For strength, you need to lift weights, concentrating on what Professor Fitz, he's an exercise physiologist at Marquette University, what Professor Fitz calls the anti-gravity muscles, those of the back and legs, and he adds, you should also maintain arm strength. And then he says that while many people do walk and lift weights, they often don't use the correct techniques. Sometimes they buy weights that are too light. Others go to gyms where they're intimidated when they venture into weight rooms filled with people grunting and straining, machines that can seem daunting. This is especially true of women. Women often say they're afraid they will bulk up, but this fear is unfounded, Dr. Kramer and others say. Acquiring muscle mass requires testosterone levels the women don't have. Instead, the toning that many women say they want comes from lifting heavy weights. And we also know that weight training is a way to strengthen bone density and avoid osteoporosis, or certainly delay it. And then it gets into some detail about the most effective way to stimulate muscles. You can do this in 3 hours a week, and alternating with heavy weights and medium weight weights and lighter weights. There's too much detail here for me to go into, but. And then it ends where one of these doctors, he quotes, says, I still lift because it makes doing other stuff, yard work, carrying groceries, carrying grandkids, easier. I think some folks outlive their muscles, meaning that they are fine mentally and cardiac-wise, but have so little muscle strength that they can't catch themselves with their other leg when they start to fall. And if they fall, they cannot get up. Okay. And then more about exercise. I am not apologetic about devoting a Taisho to trying to talk everyone, including myself, into getting more exercise. This is, I think, many of us in meditation tend to neglect our bodies, but we pay a price for that. This next article is called "To Avoid Boomeritis: Exercise, Exercise, Exercise." And here too, the author Jane Brody, who's a regular writer for the New York Times, she says there's much more to becoming and staying physically fit as you age than engaging in regular aerobic activity. There's also a dire need for exercises that improve posture and increase strength, flexibility, and balance. These exercises can greatly reduce the risk of injuries from sports and other things. And this tendency to get injured as we get older, she's calling boomeritis. By their 40th birthday, people often have vulnerabilities, weak links, and as the first generation that is trying to stay active in droves, baby boomers are pushing their frames to the break point, says Dr. Denubile, believe it or not, who is, let's see if she's a woman. Dr. Nicholas Denubile. He points out that evolution has not kept up with the doubling of the human lifespan in the last 100 years. To counter the inevitable declines with age, we have to provide our bodies with an extended warranty. And then the author says to start by assessing your fitness. Now, this is kind of sobering, so I'm going to read some of this. There's a quiz, five domains of fitness as you age. The five domains are posture, strength, balance, flexibility, and endurance. Posture begins changing as early as the teenage years, the result of activities like prolonged sitting, carrying a heavy purse or briefcase, or working at a computer. That's the big one these days. Strength declines as muscle fibers decrease in size and number, and as the supply of nerve stimulation and energy to the muscles diminishes. Balance deteriorates as muscles tighten and weaken and joints lose their full range of motion. And then finally, flexibility declines because connective tissue throughout the body becomes less elastic. And then finally, endurance falls off because of reduced flexibility, weakened muscles, and stiffer lungs and blood vessels. And then she says, still not convinced you need to work on your fitness? See how you do on the therapist's quiz. 1. Are you not standing as straight and tall as you once did? Is walking up a flight of stairs a strain at times? Are you getting up from a chair more slowly than you used to? Is it getting harder to look to the left and right while backing up? Do you get stiff sitting through a long movie? Is standing on one leg to put on your shoe difficult or impossible? Do you trip or lose your balance more easily? Does walking or jogging a distance take longer than it used to? And then all these therapists that say the antidote to aging is activity. Inactivity magnifies age-related changes, but action maintains and increases your abilities in all five domains. Injury and arthritis are the main reasons people stop exercising. She urged those in need of a joint replacement not to postpone the surgery, which she likened to repairing a pothole. And then they advise to customize your workout based on a professional assessment of your flexibility and cardiovascular endurance, strength and balance. Ms. Albohm, a certified athletic trainer, emphasized flexibility, saying it is, quote, not optional as you age. To prevent stiffness and maintain joint mobility, you should stretch daily for 15 to 20 minutes, she said, using slow, controlled movements before or after your exercise program. For cardiovascular endurance, she recommended alternating between weight-bearing and non-weight-bearing aerobic activities 3 days a week for 30 to 45 minutes each time. Weight-bearing is walking or jogging, and non-weight-bearing is swimming or cycling. Then they emphasize that muscle strength can be increased at any age. We just read that in the previous article, even in one's 90s, to protect against falls, maintain mobility, prevent new injuries, and empower individuals. Finally, we need to worry about our bones. At least 1.5 million fragility fractures occur annually in the United States. These are breaks that result when someone falls from a standing height or less, trips over the cat, or lifts something heavy, and they affect men as well as women. A history of a fragility fracture is far more predictive of future fractures than a bone density test, Dr. Tosi said. And then it ends with a report that vitamin D inadequacies are now been more and more solidly documented. Many people are deficient in vitamin D. And then finally, this article, for good self-control, try getting religious about it. This is by John Tierney, also New York Times, and I must be a regular writer because we're not told who he is. Let's just review where we've come from so far. The recognition that whereas we have a limited ability to maintain self-discipline and self-denial and in the short run, in the long run, working at it, continuing to work at it, will develop our capacity for winning more and more of those battles. We talked about exercise. I don't really need to review that. But this article, this last one starts, if I'm serious about keeping my New Year's resolutions in 2010, should I add another one? Should the to-do list include start going to church? Let me answer that. I would say yes. For reasons already mentioned earlier, that this isn't church. This is an actual practice. And by coming to the center and sitting, or sitting at home, it's almost the same. By sitting every day, or almost every day, we are deepening that tank of willpower that can be deepened on and on, and strengthening this muscle that we call willpower. Just doing it, coming here or sitting on one's own, is, in a way, is the fundamental empowerment for maintaining all these other things that are good for our health, because they involve willpower, and this develops willpower. And then the author, this John Tierney, says, that these psychologists have reviewed 8 decades of research and concluded that religious belief and piety promote self-control. He says, "This sounded to me uncomfortably similar to the conclusion of the nuns who taught me in grade school. But Dr. McCullough has no evangelical motives. He confesses to not being much of a devotee himself. When it comes to religion," he said, "professionally, I'm a fan, but personally, I don't get down on the field much." Well, of course, in Zen, the only thing that counts is getting on the field, getting on the mat. His professional interest arose from a desire to understand why religion evolved and why it seems to help so many people. Researchers around the world have repeatedly found that devoutly religious people tend to do better in school, live longer, have more satisfying marriages, and be generally happier. These results have been ascribed to the rules imposed on believers and to the social support they receive from fellow worshipers, but these external factors didn't account for all the benefits. In the new paper, it was published in Psychological Bulletin, in the new paper, the Miami psychologists surveyed the literature to test the proposition that religion gives people internal strength. And they reported, "For a long time, it wasn't cool for social scientists to study religion, but some researchers were quietly chugging along for decades. When you add it all up, it turns out there are remarkably consistent findings that religiosity correlates with higher self-control." Let me just say that what they're calling religiosity, I would say that a meditation practice like Zen is the heart of that. It's the essence of it. Just going to church for social reasons and to wear a new outfit or something it's hard to measure anything else as far as people going to church, how religious they are, other than just their attendance at church, which can be pretty superficial reasons. But this is where we distinguish ourselves, those of us who have to sit without moving for periods of 30, 35 minutes. This is a whole different order of what they're calling religiosity. I would say spirituality, because it's not just a matter of believing what's taught in the religion. It's really walking the walk, doing the work, when there may be so many other things we'd rather do. As early as the 1920s, researchers found that students who spent more time in Sunday school did better at laboratory tests measuring their self-discipline. Subsequent studies showed that religiously devout children were rated relatively low in impulsiveness by both parents and teachers, and that religiosity repeatedly correlated with higher self-control among adults. Devout people were found to be more likely than others to wear seatbelts, go to the dentist, and take vitamins. And then he raises this very essential question. But which came first, the religious devotion or the self-control? It takes self-discipline to sit through Sunday school or services at a temple or mosque, so people who start out with low self-control are presumably less likely to keep attending. But even after taking that self-selection bias into account, Dr. McCullough said, there is still reason to believe that religion has a strong influence. And this is very interesting. Brain scan studies have shown that when people pray or meditate, there's a lot of activity in two parts of the brain that are important for self-regulation and control of attention and emotion. The rituals that religions have been encouraging for thousands of years seem to be a kind of anaerobic workout for self-control. In one personality study, strongly religious people, and that would include anyone who has a daily practice of meditation, of course, strongly religious people were compared with people who subscribed to more general spiritual notions, like, well, I give them examples. The religious people scored relatively high in conscientiousness and self-control, whereas the spiritual people tended to score relatively low. Spiritual meaning just holding these notions in the mind, subscribing to the idea that we're all one or something just amorphous like that. Thinking about the oneness of humanity and the unity of nature doesn't seem to be related to self-control, Dr. McCullough said. The self-control effect seems to come from being engaged in religious institutions and behaviors. Does this mean that non-believers like me should start going to church? Even if you don't believe in a supernatural God, you could try improving your self-control by at least going along with the rituals of organized religion. But that probably won't work either, Dr. McCullough told me, because personality studies have identified a difference between true believers and others who attend services for extrinsic reasons, like wanting to impress people or make social connections. The intrinsically religious people have higher self-control, but the extrinsically religious do not. And then the author, who he refers to himself as a heathen a couple of times here. He says, what's a heathen to do? In the coming year, Dr. McCullough's advice is to try replicating some of the religious mechanisms that seem to improve self-control, like private meditation or public involvement with an organization that has strong ideals. This is the wonderful thing about Zen. You don't have to believe in squat. You don't have to believe in Buddhism. Just do it. Just do the practice, and you'll see the results if you persist at it long enough. So we see this mutually fortifying effect of the sitting, doing the sitting, and how that helps us develop the willpower to get ourselves to eat better and to exercise more, and to avoid behavior that is going to get us into trouble and be self-destructive, and also behavior that will interfere, that will hinder our efforts at the daily meditation. And certainly, if I speak from experience, if we maintain enough, let's just start with strength. Just do some moderate weekly strength training. We're going to find that we have less pain in the sitting. Not to mention flexibility. If we can do a steady practice of stretching, this will also help the sitting. And then the sitting, helps us with the other areas of our life, and it's all one package of making the effort, and then the effort becomes easier as we go on. It's like this intimate connection between the upright living and meditation. They really reinforce each other, but it has to start with just doing it, doing the sitting, or maybe try the exercise first. But the danger with starting from the exercise part is we may be using up our time, our free time with exercise, and leaving nothing for the sitting. And you know, when it all comes down to essentials, what is really the point of extending our lives, even extending our flexibility and strength and cardiovascular health, and ignoring, neglecting this essential work of what it means to be alive, what we can do to help others, and not just work on our own self-improvement. That's great. That can enable us to more effectively help others. But Zen is part of the Mahayana tradition of Buddhism, and there the emphasis always is on yes, developing our own body-mind vehicle, but as a way to give to others and to really serve others, and ultimately to come to understand what it really means to be born with a human body mind, and the great opportunity that is to understand the nature of existence, our own nature, and the nature of reality. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.